Today's text 18. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narada Vacha. Puranjana Swamahishim. Nirikshavadutam Buhi. Tatsangum Mapita Gyanu. Vaiklavyam Paramam Yayo. Narada Vacha. Puranjana Swamahishim. Nirikshavadutam Buhi. Tatsangum Mapita Gyano. Vaiklavyam Paramam Yayo. Vaishnavis, Narada Vacha. The great sage Narada spoke. Puranjana, King Puranjana, Swamahishim, his own queen, Niriksha, after seeing Avadhuta appearing like a mendicant, Bhuvi, on the ground, Tat, her, Sangha, by association, Umatita, encouraged. Jnanam, whose knowledge. Vaiklavyam, bewilderment. Paramam, supreme. Yayo, obtained. Translation. The great sage Narada continued, "My dear King Prachinadhari, as soon as King Puranjana saw his queen lying on the ground, appearing like a mendicant, he immediately became bewildered." Purport by Srila Prabhupada. In this verse, the word avadhutam is especially significant, for it refers to a mendicant who does not take care of his body. Since the queen was lying on the ground without bedding and proper dress, King Puranjana became very much aggrieved. In other words, he repented that he had neglected his intelligence and had engaged himself in the forest in killing animals. In other words, when one's good intelligence is separated or neglected, he fully engages in sinful activities. Due to neglecting one's good intelligence or Krishna consciousness, one becomes bewildered and engages in sinful activities. Upon realizing this, a man becomes repentant. Such repentance is described by Narottam Das Thakur. Hari Hari Vipale Janama Gunainu Manusha Janama Paya Radha Krishna Nabhojya Janya Shunya Vishakainu. Narottam Das Thakur here says that he repents for having spoiled his human life and knowingly drunk poison. By not being Krishna conscious, one willingly brings the poison of material life. The purport is that one certainly becomes addicted to sinful activities when he becomes devoid of his good chaste wife, or when he has lost his good sense and does not take to Krishna consciousness. Omagyati mirandasya giranjana sarapaya chakshiru maritam iratasmai shri guru gheena. Translation again, if you'd like to repeat. The great sage Narada continued, "My dear King Prachinadhari, as soon as King Puranjana saw his queen lying on the ground, appearing like a mendicant, he immediately became bewildered." This is a scene of great sadness and repentance, bewilderment. There's a lot of tears involved. A lot of pain, misunderstanding, sense of betrayal. I decided to discuss about the parallel between this situation and what sometimes we experience in our communities all over the world. I'm talking about this especially because we have our guests for the Bhakti Viksha convention, and many of them experience firsthand the situations. Many of them are leading different communities in different ways. Sometimes we see that in relation between devotees of the community, what we call congregation or home-based devotees, and their local ISKCON officers, temple presidents, and so on. There is a similar feeling, not always, fortunately, but often there is this tension, is this bewilderment. There are concerns and complaints from both sides. Like yesterday, some devotees from a certain place, they were telling me how they preach, they make devotees, and these devotees become ready for initiation. And for some reason, the local authority, who is part of his functions, is to give recommendation. Somehow, he refuses to give recommendation. And sometimes the people are asked to wait 3 years, 5 years, without any specific reason, any concrete argument. And so, there are, in this case, the congregation, meaning the devotees based at home, suffer because they feel, look, I'm doing everything, I'm ready to become initiated, and somehow I just have to wait indefinitely. There's a place, I won't mention the name of the place, I won't mention the people involved, because that's not the point is a principle. There's a place I know of. There's a devotee, a congregational devotee, a businessman. He is very successful in attracting a lot of people. He travels different towns. And last year, he was telling me how he has 60 devotees ready for initiation. Which is a very remarkable feat. No, you bring 60 people ready for initiation. And for some reason, the local temple president, who is supposed to give this recommendation, just basically saying that, as far as I know, these people chant and they follow the principle, so you can take initiation. He refuses to give this recommendation. And again, a lot of feelings, one side, the other side. The temple president says, oh well, this devotee preacher has got a trust, and this trust is not fully in the name of ISKCON. Therefore, according to, is not properly situated according to this country's law, internal ISKCON law, so I cannot give recommendation to his people. I was personally present one day when the East GBC, the GBC of this temple president, who is also his guru, initiating guru, he was telling him, these are two separate issues. The issue of the trust, which is a legal issue, and which is specifically in relation to one devotee in that community, is one issue. And the issue of recommending these people, these dozens of people who are ready for initiation, and they want to be initiated, they are eager to get initiated, they cannot take initiation, it's a separate issue. I was personally present, it's a separate issue. But somehow, the temple president didn't want to listen, even to the GBC, his guru, he just said, no. And so, in that particular case, and in other cases, those people, although ready to get initiated, so to move on in their spiritual life, commit, dedicate themselves formally, officially, they are held almost captive to this situation. There are other cases where it's the temple authorities who suffer. My observation is that sometimes this suffering is due to false expectations. Yesterday, one devotee was telling me that the local managers somewhere were feeling very bad because some devotees in the communities, senior devotees, they were preaching, they were making devotees, they were organizing groups, but not directly under the authority of this temple president, or the management, you could say. And so this devotee was telling me how the manager was actually suffering, was actually feeling a great mental agony. Why these people are not under me? And I just asked him, to this devotee, but why they should be under him? I mean, where is it written that they have to work under him? You're talking about a large city. Srila Prabhupada often spoke about having a multiplicity of entities in a particular city, especially large cities. They do their thing, they preach Krishna consciousness. So where this idea come from? And the devotee actually couldn't answer. So Srila Prabhupada, for instance, talking about Mumbai, which is a large city. How many people live in Mumbai? 8 million? 9 million? 20 million. So 20 million. We are talking about 20 million people in the Mumbai area. So which makes one of the most populous cities in the world. And so Srila Prabhupada was talking about, in a lecture in Mumbai, he was saying that we should have, here in Mumbai, we should have hundreds and thousands of centers. So what does it mean? I mean, when we hear such a statement, we may feel inspired. Wow, imagine Mumbai, hundreds and thousands of ISKCON centers. Basically, every neighborhood would have one or more ISKCON temples. So we feel, at face value, we feel inspired. It's a very enthusing, energizing vision. At the same time, let's analyze what that means for the local temple authorities. It means you are living in a very intense situation of competition. Because you are offering a certain, let's say, product, you are offering a certain experiences, you're offering a certain service, and hundreds of other temples offer the same. So certainly, there will be a lot of, although the vision is inspiring, there will be a lot of tension. Because even from a conservative, say, analysis, say 200 temples. 200 temples in Mumbai means that any person living in any given point in Mumbai will have to choose. Do I go to this temple? Do I go to the next temple? Do I go to the next temple? And they will have to make their own considerations. Maybe they like a particular preaching in a temple. Maybe they like that, okay, this temple is the closest to my home. Maybe it's a walking distance, I go there. Maybe they feel that, well, I have children, so maybe this temple is a little more far, but it offers a better Sunday program, Sunday school for the children, so I go there. So you will see that there are hundreds of temple presidents managing these temples, which I actually have to face the situation. And this is what Srila Prabhupada wanted. It's not an anomaly. And in fact, it's manifesting gradually. Now in Mumbai we have about established four temples. And people choose where to go. Already people choose where to go, depending on the inspiration they get. And there's not really much we can do. This is the system. People are free to choose whom they feel inspired, whom they give money to. It's their money. They earn their money. They decide whom to give it to. Imagine there is a congregation of devotees, financially self-sufficient devotees, visiting Mayapur. He may have some money to give in charity. you will have to decide. Even in Mayapur, there are so many options. Maybe they have had a very good experience with the tourist department, so they'll give a donation to the tourist department. Maybe they are inspired by the cows, the goshala, so they give to the goshala. Maybe they are inspired by education, so they may give to one school or the other, or another school. Maybe they are inspired by this project, the Temple of Vedic Planetarium. And there are many other ways or places they can donate. And actually, really, if you think of it, nobody can really tell them where they should donate. They may want to donate to the deities. And even within the deities, they may wish to donate to a particular deity. Yesterday, I was witnessing a family, a visiting family. They donated a mirror, a handmade, decorated mirror with all sorts of conchs, to the Jagannath Mandir, Jagannath deities. It's their choice. They felt to donate the mirror to Jagannath. Who can tell them, no, you cannot donate to Jagannath, you have to donate to Nrisimhadev or Panchatattva. So there is this sense of individual freedom that needs to be cherished, as devotional service is based on freedom, and needs to be, as a society, we need to imbibe it very deeply. Because this individual freedom is not going away, and especially in a community in the big sense, as a big society, where most people are financially self-sufficient, monetarily independent, they live at home, they will have to choose their allegiance, which temple to go, which project to support, and obviously on the most basic level, which guru they want to take initiation from. They may be inspired by a local guru, they may be inspired by somebody else. And there is not really much we can do, or we should do. It's just the natural thing to do. And unfortunately, there is suffering. Like we see here, the suffering, the agony of the wife, the Mahishi, the queen of Puranjana. There is suffering. Sometimes there is a suffering because just times change, and a model which worked in a certain time, it doesn't work anymore in a different time. Like for instance in ISKCON in the 60s and the 70s, we knew a ISKCON where basically everybody would live in the temple, and the temple president would basically regulate all aspects of life for everybody. Nowadays, we live in an ISKCON, an International Society for Krishna Consciousness, where roughly 98-99% of people don't live in the temple. Their daily life, their sadhana, is not directly supervised or regulated by the temple president. The temple president may facilitate their engagement to the extent they want to interact with the temple, but really it's up to the individual how much they want to interact, how much they want to contribute. Organizations go through different phases. Any organization, religious organization, profit organization, they go through different phases. There is a phase which is like pioneer stage, where there is a lot of freedom. There is a lot of uncharted territory, and people do more or less what they want. And in some case, again, maybe one temple in one city is enough, because that's the kind of public or audience you have to serve. Then it comes another phase in the life of the same movement, in which one temple in one city is not enough. And so it comes to a culture of, religiously speaking, it's a free economy, free market economy. You offer a service to the community, and according to how well you offer the service, people can choose to come and take advantage of your services. I remember I was born and raised in Rome as a Christian Catholic. I remember, you can imagine, in Rome there are a lot of churches, a lot of parishes. I remember my wife, we were living in a street, just on one street there were four or five different churches. And I remember my mother, sometimes we would go to our official parish, where we took the sacraments, you know, the samskaras. Like, that was our official parish. We were registered there. But sometimes she would go to another church, because the other church would do the mass in the evening, so it was more comfortable. I remember her once saying, "I like this priest, how he preaches, so I'm going to listen to him." It's called free market economy. There's a regulatory body, in that case the Catholic Church, who says, okay, these churches, these preachers are authorized. But then the person will choose to go one place and choose another place. And maybe one priest feels bad, because, look, you were coming to my church, you were listening to my sermons, you were giving money to my church, and now you're going to the next church. And this, it may feel very bad, but that's the way it is. And better people really kind of absorb, assimilate this reality. Otherwise, there's a lot of unnecessary suffering. Unnecessary suffering. The suffering is real, but it's based on a false expectation. I'll give you an example. Say you have a child, a son, somewhere else, and he is fine, he's doing great, he's in good health, he's doing great. But somebody comes and tells you, "You know what? Your son died." It's not true. Not true. But somebody tells you, "Your son died. It was a car accident. Your son is no more." Now, although that's a false information, your son is fine, but the suffering you experience is real. Your heart, your mind feels the same emotions as if that son really died. So sometime in our community, there are sufferings, and the suffering is real. We need to respect that, or at least have some empathy for that. But sometimes it's based on a false information. It's based on a false expectation. I'll give you an example. There is a very interesting letter from Srila Prabhupada, 72, to Satsvarup Maharaj. Satsvarup Maharaj was apparently the GVC at different parts of the states, including Cleveland, Ohio. And apparently Satsvarup Maharaj had written Srila Prabhupada saying that there were the black devotees, African-American devotees, who wanted to open a temple independent of the white devotees. It's just based black and white. So the black devotees wanted to open a temple independent from the white devotees. And Srila Prabhupada says, I mean, some of us may expect that Srila Prabhupada would smash the idea. That he would say, "Look, this is based on the body, we are here, we are spirit soul, we are not this body, it's a skin disease," whatever. Instead, Srila Prabhupada says, "In principle it's alright. Let the black devotees have their temple independently from the white devotees. Birds of a feather flock together," Srila Prabhupada says. Then he said, "But you go and see that the standards are maintained, and I'll be happy to accept them as initiated disciples." So you have a case where in a single city, two groups of devotees wanted to open a new temple independent from the other temple, and basically based on the ethnic considerations, racial considerations, cultural considerations. They didn't want to be with the white devotees. And Srila Prabhupada approved of it. But he said, look, as a GBC, you look at the standard, see that they do everything according, then it's fine. So this is an example of unity in diversity, which is a very, very subtle and very important topic for movement. It's so important that Srila Prabhupada wrote in a letter in 73 that the GBC every year should come to Mayapur and together with the other senior devotees, so not just the GBC, but together with the other senior devotees, they should discuss unity and diversity. How to apply unity and diversity. And some of us, by tendency or by habit, we may be more comfortable with monopoly. That monopoly, mono means one. And monopoly, we just, no, this is the temple, either you come here or you're in Maya. And monopoly is very good for those who hold the monopoly. But it's very bad for the customer. I give you an example. In Mexico, to make phone calls is very costly. It's extremely costly. It's amazingly costly. Why? Because basically there is a national monopoly, and either you use that service or you cannot make phone calls. So they can put whatever price basically. It's very costly. I don't remember exactly how much, but I remember. Extremely costly to make phone calls. In India, where there are so many phone companies, it's actually relatively very cheap. Why is cheap? Because there is competition. And these different phone companies, they strive to offer the best product. I can call US, America, from here, from Mayapur, I can speak 1 hour with the US for less than 40 rupees. Which is less than a dollar. 1 hour. One paisa per second. And there are different phone companies who use this scheme, who offer this scheme. If it was one monopoly, one phone company, then they could just ask you anything. And you have to pay. You have to use it. So monopoly is not good for the customer. Because there is no competition. There is no effort to offer a good product. How many of you have heard of this car? Trabant. Two people. Are you from Germany or? Huh? Czech Republic. See, most of us, we never heard about this brand, Trabant. Why? Because was it such a lousy car, such a bad product, that we never heard about it. We never saw it in our countries. Trabant was a car produced through monopoly, state-controlled industry in East Germany. At one point, after the Second World War, Germany was divided into two, West Germany and East Germany. And East Germany was a communist country. So the Trabant was kind of the state industry for making cars. And there was no other cars. You could not buy any other car. You could not buy West German car, American car, Japanese car, Swedish car. You could not. So you had the monopoly. Either you buy this Trabant, which was really bad, or you don't have a car. So after, when the Germans united, Trabant disappeared. Because that type of economy, that type of product could only be sustained by monopoly. As soon as you open the market, those type of products disappear. Anyway, these are some considerations I wanted to share today. Any questions or comments? Prabhu Vasudev. We have a mic.
Your comments are very important, actually. I just wanted to make one comment that the Catholic Church was faced with this idea of so many different churches and so many, especially different organizations that were appealing for charity and so forth. And they came to the conclusion that it's better to have so many people writing out letters and sending to different people Because after some time, people would just break down and give.
Pardon, after some time?
After some time, people would break down and just give donations.
Uh-huh.
So they thought, okay, it's not so much a competition, it's a constant reminder. You know, okay, if there's a church on every corner, it's a constant reminder that God is there, He's alive, and you should definitely pay attention to Him.
Okay.
So,
thank you.
Nice class.
One comment on that is that on average, the average U.S. American Catholic gives to 17 different recipients of charity. The average. So you are a Catholic in the U.S., you give to 17 different churches, missions, things. That's the average. And that's the system. So the local parish understands, I'm not going to get all the money from this person. I'm getting some of the money. Somebody else, you know, some African mission will get, maybe they send directly to the Vatican, maybe to the seminary, 17 different recipients. I was sent, 4 years ago, I was sent to Italy by the GBC strategic planning team. And I went to interview a scholar. His name is Massimo Introvigne. Is the founder of the CESNUR, is the center of studying the new religious movements. And he knows, I mean, that's what he does, he studied the religious groups, so he knows very well the Hare Krishna movement, he participates in conventions and so on. So he was telling, when I asked what people do in terms of organization, how they harmonize, you know, diversity, unity, and he was saying, his observation was that diversity, variety on the local level is very good. Because you have programs for different types of people. Some people may be attracted to education, so you have an educational institute, an academic flavor. Some people are attracted to children education, so you have schools for children, or you have Sunday schools. Some people are attracted to monastic life, where they want to become monks or nuns, and you have also a convent for that. Some people are attracted more like to social work, and you have an institution for that. So it's very good that on the ground, on the territory, the Catholic Church or any organization has a variety of offering to people, so you can attract different people with different interests. Then of course, when you go up, then there should be unity. Everybody is ultimately under the Pope. The Pope, the Vatican, they control all the Catholics in the world, all the Catholics. And sometimes they do intervene. They do intervene when they see something is not. But otherwise there's a lot of variety, and that's good for the customers, for the end user. Vasudev Prabhu? You wanted to say something? Up to what time we go? Huh? 9 o'clock? Up to 9.
Thank you, Prabhu, an interesting subject. Monopoly. It seems that both systems, monopoly or free market system, have their strengths and weaknesses. And perhaps they can both be legitimate in any system. For example, in the past, we had a marriage where it was not possible to divorce. So basically it was monopoly.
You mean in ISKCON?
No, in the world.
In the world.
It was not possible to divorce. Husband had monopoly on his wife, the wife had monopoly on the husband, and there was no question of going and see elsewhere. So there was obviously some advantages to that. And nowadays...
I mean, my understanding, that's called monogamy, not monopoly. It's a little different concept.
Yeah, the equivalent of monopoly at the individual level. But the example you took at the beginning of your class, where the temple president exercised his power to say no to initiation, for example, this might have been the only way for him to keep his people. Maybe his experience is that if he says yes, then those same people may be gone tomorrow because they will no longer have a need to stay loyal to him. Maybe the presidents get together and say that if somebody comes to you from my zone, we shouldn't accept other people so easily, because then it will just be a high turnover of people traveling around according to their whims. So couldn't both systems have their virtue, and how are we to determine which system is better?
Okay. You see, there is no real, what you call, contradiction. When there is a deregulated economy, you also need a higher body that set the standards. I give you an example. The air industry in the United States of America, the different airways. In America, anybody can open an airline. You buy your planes, you register, you get your licenses, and you can open an airline. In fact, there are dozens and maybe hundreds of airlines just in America. So there is deregulation. It's not a monopoly. It's not controlled by the state. At the same time, there is the body controlled by the government that establishes the standards. Who can fly an airplane? It's not that anybody can just buy a plane and fly. They have certain, they need certain licenses, they need certain training for the pilot, otherwise it's illegal. So there's no real, what you call, contradiction, or that the two things are not mutually exclusive. To have a higher body which set the standards and enforces the standards, and then deregulation, you leave autonomy, you leave freedom, whatever people want to do within those parameters. So the two things are not mutually exclusive. To have one single body overseeing their all operations, and then having different people offering different products or different services. Now, if we study, for instance, Srila Prabhupada, because this is his movement, after all. I mean, he's his founder, Acharya. He invented this movement. He established this movement. And we try to understand his spirit. What I see is he was a lot for deregulation. He was a lot for individual initiative. He was a lot for private initiative.
Decentralization.
Huh?
He used to say decentralization.
Yeah, but decentralization to the point of the individual, not just to the point of the temple. Like, for instance, he writes in the book, I have a few quotes here. For instance, in Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, therefore in the book, he says, it is not that we have to open different centers all over the world. I mean, generally we hear Srila Prabhupada saying we need to open different centers all over the world. But here in the book he says, it is not that we have to open different centers all over the world. Whoever cares for the Krishna consciousness movement can install deities at home and under superior guidance worship the deity regularly, chanting the mantra and discussing the Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. We are actually teaching in our classes how to go about this. So, he says the same in the second canto of the Bhagavatam. The people can install deities in their homes. He says, we don't have to open different centers. We, the institution, the official ISKCON, doesn't necessarily to do that. People who are interested, they can learn and do it in their homes. There's another letter. This is a letter, 72, this is about Calcutta. There was a Marwari gentleman, Bajoria. Maybe this most senior devotee remember him, I don't know, Mr. Bajoria. And he had installed deities in the home. And apparently, this is a letter to Bhavananda, so Bhavananda Prabhu was apparently asked, Srila Prabhupada, how we should process this. So Srila Prabhupada says, Mr. Bajoria will be a very good example. We want every house to be a temple, not that our place should be the only place for the people to come. No, this should be the process, that they learn at our place, then establish the same thing at home. So this Bajoria program should be considered as one of our successful points of preaching. Another quote on this. This is a quote to a young Grihastha couple. This is very early, 1968. These were like a first, one of the first Grihastha couples in ISKCON. Their name is Annapurna and Ananda. And Srila Prabhupada writes to them, "It is not very difficult to open a center for our activities. You can remain in any apartment as husband and wife and invite persons there to hear your chanting and topics. That is our center, and let it be gradually improved." So if we study Srila Prabhupada as an author, as a spiritual leader, as the founder Acharya, we see again and again in books, in lectures, in letters, this idea of unity in diversity, this idea that we should have a standard, a unity of standards for initiation, for instance. Not that one guru gives 16 rounds, another guru 4 rounds, another guru 1 round. So unity, so you could say monopoly in standards. But then in terms of application, there is a very vast variety. And not everything has to be officially, legally, under the institution. There's a famous quote in the third canto. This is third canto Bhagavatam. So this is book, this is main books from Srila Prabhupada. And books that we distribute in the street to everybody. This is Bhagavatam, third canto, 21 chapter, 31st verse. A person who is a householder but is initiated by a sannyasi has the duty to spread Krishna consciousness at home. As far as possible, he should call his friends and neighbors to his house and hold classes in Krishna consciousness. Holding a class means chanting the holy name of Krishna and speaking from Bhagavad Gita or Srimad Bhagavatam. So this is the epitome of decentralization, where every householder, Srila Prabhupada says, has the duty, is the dharma of every householder to make their house into a reference point for spiritual life. So when you do that, obviously you'll have so many reference points in the city. Krishna consciousness will be available, it will be sustainable. It is not a burden on the temple, because this will be self-sustained, self-maintained. And not only that, but the householders will advance, because their dharma is not just to earn money and give money to the temple, to some other institution. Their dharma is to become also shelter, guide for others. And this is a Bhagavatam instruction, the duty.
One other question. What was the result of this temple president who did not want to have these people initiated? And how does it happen that by bylaws and so forth, even GBC and Guru cannot correct such a person? What was the ultimate result of that?
Still pending. There's still a lot of pain. It's not resolved. And that's not the only place. This issue of recommendation is in many places in the world.
So if the guru
it's very
is,
sad,
if
but
a guru
like
is willing to accept, huh? If a guru is willing to accept, and he has between him and the disciple, potential disciple, you could say a bureaucrat, what is that? That doesn't make any sense. We have guru, sadhu, and shastra, the relationship between the guru and the and the disciple is, you know, heartfelt. How can I step in between? That's actually that's an offense to step in between the husband and wife or the guru and the disciple.
I agree. Sometimes a law can be, see, if we understand the spirit of the law, then we can apply the law properly. So the spirit of the law about recommendation, which is a system that Srila Prabhupada had, I mean, I'm sure you remember, there was, you know, even a time of Srila Prabhupada, you had to be recommended to be initiated. So the system is bona fide, and the spirit is to protect the guru from unqualified disciples, somebody just walks in from the street, I want to be initiated. And then, you know, it dumps so much karma on the guru, you know, it creates a very bad impression for the movement. And also to protect the disciple from guru, which are maybe over eager to collect disciples. And also to protect the disciples so that they can have some training. Or at least they can have, okay, one period you show that you can chant 60 rounds, you can follow the principles. So somebody who knows the disciple can say, yeah, as far as I know, he's chanting, he's following, I think he can take initiation. So he recommends. But unfortunately, this, which is the spirit of the law, is not taken in this spirit, it's taken as a power tool. That you, I'm not giving you recommendation. If you don't show a particular surrender to me as a person, so I'm not just supervising or facilitating the relation. I'm actually interrupting, like you were saying, interrupting the relation. So it's a sad situation. I mean, we are in this material world, well, because we want to control, and sometimes when we have the chance to control, we use it to the max. On any position, as a husband, as a mother, as an elder brother, in a school, we have bullies. I'm not saying here, I'm saying in the school system in the world. So this is the material world. Sometimes we have a position and we use it as a tool for control. Yes, Vasudeva Prabhu. I think this is the last question or comment. Huh?
I've got a mic. Prabhu, yeah. You pointed out how Prabhupada, this is Prabhupada's system, recommendation. But Prabhupada's philosophy and teaching is that naturally, the most natural situation is when the preacher, the person who is taking care of the newcomer, becomes the guru.
Uh-huh.
The relationship is between them. And perhaps, again, as I mentioned earlier, one reason why those temple presidents would behave in this way, aside from them being bad, you know, they may have good reasons that if they allow the initiation to go through, then perhaps the guru will simply instruct the disciple to go elsewhere, to do something else for him. Because then the relationship has to shift in some ways, which would not be a very natural, or as much a natural relationship as the first one.
See, anything can happen, okay? So the guru may give a crazy instruction to a disciple, okay? It happened many times. Now, we need to do something about that also. We need to protect the movement about that. So even above the gurus, there is a system that you cannot just become guru, or sometimes gurus have been suspended in ISKCON because they were not acting as gurus properly, either their personal life or the way they instructed, so many aspects. So the guru should also have some sort of supervision, again in the spirit of help, of service to the community. At the same time, I mean, some of this, obviously you're talking in general, you're not arguing because you're talking about the principle. People, these are congregational devotees. They live there. They have the house there, the family there, they work there. We are not going to witness an exodus, you know, that the 60 people, the day they take initiation, the guru will tell, okay, now you're initiated, now move to Mongolia. It won't help. It won't happen.
So are you saying that the temple presidents are bad? Why are they holding?
No, no. Why first of all, temple presidents, we cannot, what do you call? Generalize.
But there is an issue.
I mean, many temple presidents are great saints. I'm talking about a particular mentality, a particular situation that sometimes we see. It may be in 10% of the temples in the world, maybe in more. So I'm not saying bad or good. I'm saying that sometimes there is a false expectation. There is a false perception of what is the limits of one jurisdiction. And that false perception creates a lot of pain. Because, again, as I said, sometimes they believe, some people believe it's my duty to control these people. And it's an illusory idea. But the pain is real. And of course, the pain of those who are supposed to be controlled is also real. So we need to grow up. We need to grow up. I give you, as a conclusion, I read one GBC resolution, which, as often, people don't know about, or even if they know, don't follow. This is a resolution passed in 2008. It's entitled Jurisdiction of ISKCON Centers. Please listen attentively. This is ISKCON law. Whereas ISKCON has grown into an organization with multifaceted preaching programs, whereas it may not be possible for a single temple or project to cover all such preaching programs, whereas the GBC would like to encourage ISKCON members' individual initiatives to preach, resolved that multiple ISKCON entities can be accommodated in a particular city or geographical area. Multiple ISKCON entities. Such entities should work cooperatively with existing ISKCON temples and projects. Any concerns that arise in the course of expanding ISKCON's preaching in this fashion should be worked out amongst the leaders of those projects and or the zonal secretaries for that area. In other words, ideally, everything should be done in cooperation, in harmony. I'm opening another center, is okay. But worked out among the leader and or with the zonal secretary. In other words, even if the local leaders don't come to an agreement, ultimately it's the zonal secretary who decides. So we have a common authority, but we have freedom. The GBC would like to encourage ISKCON members' individual initiatives to preach. So thank you very much for your attention. Today, as you may have heard, there is the Bhakti Riksha Convention. Everybody is welcome. It's a free entrance. We start at 10:30 at the Samadhi Auditorium. If you're here from outside Mayapur, at 10 o'clock we have a registration. We want your names. It's free, but we want to register you. At 10 o'clock, please be at the Samadhi Auditorium. At 10:30 we'll start the presentations. And for those who come from outside Mayapur, there is breakfast for you, also free. Free breakfast in the big kitchen. Big kitchen, not near the Samadhi. Big kitchen, ask anybody. So thank you very much for your attention. Grantara Shrimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai. Unity in diversity Ki Jai.